And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And this is the second interview for this evening, which is our author portion of the evening. And, you know, I'm really excited about this interview because rarely do I read a book these days that, you know, has had the power to, you know, create some changes in my life. And, you know, this book offers tools for transformation that are really simple and direct ways to assist us to become much more present and in the now. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Richard Moss, who has written the book, The Mandala of Being, Discovering the Power of Awareness.
Hi, Lori.
How are you?
I'm wonderful, actually.
That's great. So typically, we start the session off with a little bit about how you sort of came into this work. So, you know, what sort of started you on this journey?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. The first image that comes into my mind is the richness, the depth to which people can experience change inside themselves under certain kinds of circumstances. You know, intensive courses, retreats, meditation retreats, many kinds of things. And I've been doing a kind of retreat work now for more than 30 years with small groups of people. And people make deep changes. You can cultivate presence. You can cultivate connection to yourself. Insight spontaneously arises from that. Clarity about life purpose comes. We can uncover some of the shadow, the unconscious parts of ourselves and start to steer a clearer course in our lives. But what I also saw was that these kinds of effects can be pretty temporary sometimes. That something along the lines of a real path, a deeper understanding of our minds and how we create unnecessary suffering for ourselves and how we limit our potential is really important. And so it was born out of the question, why do people take such deep steps forward and then lose connection to it, that the work in the mandala of being was born. I also had to address the same thing in myself. Why was it that being a guide and a teacher is such an easy place in a way that I can maintain a sense of presence, a sense of clarity, of impartiality, of openness, and even empathy and compassion in the context of working and teaching? But then I can go home. I could go home and be quite a jerk with my wife, impatient, judgmental, with, you know, self-protective, reactive, and even with the kids too. And so I asked the question, what do I do differently when I'm working and than when I'm at home? And that's how the mandala work came into place. I really began to watch the difference in what I was doing, and it became a path.
That's a good place to start, because I think many of us, you know, probably have very similar experiences. I think it's very easy to be very present when we're, you know, working with others and our clients and, you know, providing that space. And yeah, life happens and we get caught up in it. So let's start. This is a very exciting book because, you know, really we could probably do 10 shows on it and still have enough material to give people, you know, a really great understanding of what you're talking about. We're going to try and do it in an hour, and then maybe we'll have you back, because I think it's really important work that you're doing, and I think that this book is really instrumental in helping us, you know, really identify within ourselves those patterns. So, you know, you make a statement near the beginning about how everything in life is always about relationship, and, you know, nothing exists that is not defined by relationship. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that's important for people to understand.
Yeah. Well, I know the first thing that comes to people's minds when they hear that is they think about their couple.
Of course.
Or they think about their marriage, or they think about their boyfriend or their girlfriend. And maybe then the next thing they think about is professional relationships, or, you know, of course, family relationships to children. But I was talking about that everything is a relationship. The consciousness itself is a dynamic of relationship. And so I was pointing to not only the relationships between people, but very importantly, the relationship between a person, you or me or anyone that's listening, and your own thoughts. I mean, obviously, you have thoughts, and you can't consider your own thoughts unless there's some part of you that's observing your thoughts. So that's a relationship. And you have feelings, and feelings can be sensations in the body. But if you don't consider the sensation, then you can't name it, and you can't wonder why it's there, and you can't appreciate it if it's pleasant, or check with the doctor if it seems to be something that might indicate, illness. And so there's, again, a relationship you have with your own sensations and your own feelings. And you have a relationship with your own emotions. You know when you're angry, and if you want to, you can ask yourself, why am I angry? And so that's the essential notion, that everything is relationship. And what few of us realize is that we have an enormous power in the way we bring our awareness into observation of our thoughts, observation of our emotions, observation of our feelings and sensations, and that if you are very gentle in the way you consider yourself, you tend to live in a world that is gentle. And if you are very judgmental and aggressive and harsh in the way you consider your own feelings, your own thoughts, your own emotions, your own body, when you look in the mirror and you get on the scale, then you tend to live in a very painful world, a harsh world. And so that notion that being aware is a relationship, being conscious is a relationship, is the essence of what I'm pointing to in the book, because I'm saying the power that you have with your awareness is that whatever you're aware of, let's say you're aware of a feeling, you can feel that feeling because a part of you is more than that feeling, which means you have a choice whether to be completely defined by the feeling or aware of the feeling, or defined by an emotion or aware of the emotion. And it may be, it's I think a real surprise to people to realize that if you develop the power of your awareness, eventually you can face even the most difficult and dark and threatening kinds of feelings, and instead of identifying with them and saying, this is me because I feel this is me and there's something wrong with me, you can actually look at the feeling and say, well, this is a feeling, and it's not different in a certain sense than, let's say, tasting a piece of fruit or smelling a particular smell. If you smell a rose, you wouldn't say to yourself, I'm a rose. but you're aware of the smell and you appreciate the smell. And if it was an offensive smell, you wouldn't say, I'm this offensive smell. But yet when we look at our own feelings, when we look at our own emotions, and when we look at our own thoughts, we don't say, oh, this is something I'm aware of, like I'm aware of the smell of the rose. This is something that I am. This is something I have to believe in. This is my identity. My identity is tied up with these thoughts, or my identity is tied up and conflated, confused with these feelings. And that leads to tremendous problems for us in our world, in our communication within ourselves and between each other.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that we become who we are not. We believe that there's something wrong with us that needs to be fixed, and that we have to do something to be worthy.
Well, let's say you're a little kid. Let's say you're an infant, and we all know that we don't remember much of that, because there's not an ego there. There's not a sense of separate self or me that's yet in place. But I'm a little child. I'm a baby. I'm a young child, and my parents are fighting, and that creates an atmosphere that's very, very scary. And so I feel this disruption, this emotional disruption, and I start to cry and I become afraid to express crying, I learn to be afraid to express crying, mm-hmm. and I hold it back in. What happens is I don't realize that these are changing sensations, kind of like changing weather in my sense of being. Now I'm 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old, and I'm beginning to really become a separate person. And I look at these feelings and I say, they are me. I don't say, they're caused by my parents fighting, or I don't say they're caused because my mother's unhappy, or I don't say it's caused because I've got a bad cold, or I can't get to play with the other children the way I want to. I identify with these feelings, and I say, this is me. And so all of this gets buried, and we end up with a kind of place inside of us. Sometimes we could call it pain, but sometimes it's just a kind of restlessness or a distress or something. And I call it, this isn't it. or I also call it what we interpret it to be. We interpret it that there's something wrong with us. We say, I'm not sufficient as I am. This isn't it. Life isn't quite right. Something's wrong with me. And this is the story we tell ourselves about something that we're feeling that didn't ever originate. I didn't do it to myself. I can't say that what I feel that was caused by my parents' unhappiness is mine, any more than I could say that the weather is raining today and that's me and I caused that. And so this deep feeling that many people have, I think all people have it at some level, that something's not quite right, and maybe that drives them to you know, be very busy, to kind of avoid that feeling or to try to overcome it because the culture says if you're wealthy and you have the right woman and the right house and the right car, then you're going to feel satisfied with who you are. But deep down, we don't feel satisfied with who we are. And we identify with it, and we think there's something wrong with us, and we project it, and we say, well, I'm okay, but there's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
So we make enemies, and we judge other people, and we separate our group from other groups, just like we separate ourselves from other people. And if you can make peace with this sensation of that you call, I'm not sufficient as I am, or you call, something's wrong with me, or this isn't it, then you can start living right in the present moment. In fact, it's only in the present moment that you can use your awareness to look at this sensation and realize this isn't me, but this is a sensation I recognize. This is a feeling that I recognize. And I can treat it the way I would treat a sunset or a storm. I can watch it. I can make space for it. I can treat it the way a wise mother or a wise parent would treat a distressed child. You pick the distressed child up, you talk to it, you stroke it, I know what it's like to walk around with my grandson when he's crying and to just make sounds and make movements and, you know, vibrate his body and stroke him and until he starts to come back to himself, until whatever is distressing him passes and he gets happy again. He gets present and alert or he falls asleep peacefully. And the same thing is true with us. We don't have to be the victims of this very deep, very buried, below the surface in our subconscious minds, identification with a sense of something wrong with us. There's absolutely nothing wrong with us, not anything at all wrong with us, but we can and must learn to be present with feelings that we interpret as something wrong with us.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big, big difference between holding something in your awareness and being identified with it and saying something's wrong with me.
Mm-hmm. You make a point that, and I think this is really the basis of everything that we're talking about, but that what we are aware of depends on where we place our attention. And so we have me stories, you stories, past, future, and hopefully present.
Well, now you're really stepping into the mandala.
Mm-hmm.
So the audience needs to know that the word mandala, and most people are familiar with mandalas. They're geometric patterns. They're basically circles. The word itself is an old Sanskrit word. It's an ancient language. It means circle. But in Eastern contemplative religious traditions, these are sacred art forms that are designed to tell us, to represent, symbolically represent, the nature of the mind, the nature of consciousness, and the journey that we take to become enlightened, or the journey that we take to become wise, the journey we take out of the delusion and illusions that are created by our ego self. And so in this mandala, the one I call the mandala of being, the thing you want to recognize is you don't have to learn to live in the now, because it's quite impossible to be any other place but now. What you have to learn is how your mind takes you away from the now. And that's where what you just said comes in. What I realized was that even though we're always in the present moment, our minds will take us into the future. And when it does, we can tell ourselves a story, a thought that can scare us, or a thought that can make us feel very excited in a good way. If our minds take us into the past, we have our memories. The memory isn't the problem. It's the thought we have about the memory. So let's say I was a 13-year-old, and my father left the family, and my mother was, had to take extra jobs and was never home. And I've been telling myself a story about being abandoned when I was 13 years old by my father, and judging my father. And now I'm 45 years old, and if I look at the memory and I tell the same past story, I have the same psychology of a 13-year-old, except I'm 45 years old. So in essence, even though I don't have a single atom in my body that was the same as when I was 13, not a single cell, not a single molecule, not a single atom, my whole organism has been completely redone. My mind is the same mind of a 13-year-old. And that's the problem with the past. It turns us into the past. And it doesn't allow us to see the present moment as it is. So there's time. We go into the future, we go into the past. But there's also two other places we go, which is we go into judgments about ourselves, stories about ourselves. And when we tell ourselves a story, we can never tell ourselves who we really are, because that would be impossible. It really is impossible. I mean, we'll say of course, we can identify ourselves in conventional senses, like saying I'm a man or I'm a woman or I'm 6 foot tall or I weigh 110 pounds and so on and so forth. I'm not talking about what we would call factual information. I'm talking about the way we make ourselves special by stories about ourselves that either make us feel bigger or smaller, make us feel inflated and important, or make us feel inadequate and insufficient. And so this tendency to make ourselves special with the thoughts we tell ourselves, and we do the exact same thing with stories about other people. We make ourselves in the present moment angry or resentful or bitter or jealous or envious or hurt or wounded according to the kind of thought we have, the kind of story that we have and identify with about our spouse, about a coworker, about our own children, about other people. But we can also tell ourselves stories about the Republicans or the Democrats or the socialists, capitalists, and about money or about God. And we become emotionally determined by the quality or the kind of story we tell. So the circle is like a clock. At 12 o'clock are the future stories. At the center is the now. At 6 o'clock are the past stories. At 3 o'clock are the stories about other people. And at 9 o'clock are all the stories about you. And all you have to do to start transforming your life profoundly is realize that none of these stories are really true except for the emotional state they create. And that if you step fully into the present moment, you start to have a very different experience of vitality, presence, aliveness, happiness. And so you learn to use the mandala to wake up when you're telling yourself a story that's making you depressed, or you're telling yourself a story that's making you special in a self-important way, or you wake up in the middle of one of the you stories that's making you bitter or resentful or angry, or you wake up in the middle of a future story that's making you scared. A future story would be like, there won't be anyone there to take care of me when I'm old, or I'm not going to have enough money to be able to continue to live in this house. Those kinds of thoughts take the present moment and make it scary, fill you up with anxiety, whereas what's actually happening in the present moment could be something very lovely. In fact, it almost always is very lovely. And so the mandala of being is a way of saying to yourself, it's always now, but sometimes I'm in the now created by future thoughts, or sometimes I'm in the now created by past thoughts. That is, I'm in the emotional state created by these thoughts. And sometimes I'm in the emotional state created by my judgments of me, And sometimes I'm in the emotional state created by my judgments of other people. And it becomes like a compass, and you navigate by it. And imagine if the compass could shout at you like a Potter compass. Wake up, wake up, you're in the past. And now you're making yourself the same psychology as you were when you were 13, 40 years ago. You know? And so that's the power of this particular teaching. It's not how you live in the now. It's just waking up to the fact that you let your mind take you away from the now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting. You talk about survival personalities and the survival mechanisms we do. I have to say that the story that you brought up, your intuition is dead on. Not that that was the beginning of my story. That was actually pretty much the last part that sort of defined the coffin, so to speak. Well, being 45 and having your father, although he didn't leave, he didn't actually leave a house. He just left the world at 13. But you know, my story actually started with the first holding environment, where I was abandoned by my mother, and then put into a foster home, and then went into adoptive home. So abandonment has definitely been the story. And when I read this book, I realized just how much the you stories have played a huge impact in my life. Because it's you know, finding the words and understanding what they mean. I mean, I've always known to look at the abandonment story. I've always been, you know, working on that. And recently I've had, you know, something come up where I didn't feel abandoned. So I knew that I had started to heal a lot of that process. But, you know, having the wording and understanding actually where we go is hugely beneficial.
Yeah, exactly. If you know there's only four places you can go when you leave the now, when you really leave being fully an embodied present in yourself, then it becomes easy to learn to come back. And I'm so happy that you were able to use the book to make it more clear about the you stories.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are people who have a lot of anxiety. And I know immediately when someone says they have a lot of anxiety that they tend to live in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And they look back at the past and see things that didn't work. And then they go into the future and they create a thought in their mind about something that won't work, or something that's dangerous, or something that's scary, or something that might not happen, or something that might happen that they're afraid will happen. And they have all this anxiety because their mind is in the future. They don't have themselves planted in the present moment. They're not in the now. They're not in their own bodies. They're not in their own breath. They're not in their own perceptions. They don't actually see the quality of light. They don't actually smell what's happening. They don't actually hear the sounds. All they hear is this atmosphere created by these thoughts about the future that are making them anxious. And, you know, the remedy is to realize, oh, I'm scaring myself. I'm making myself anxious now because I'm in the future. And you just start practicing coming back to the present. I call it coming to the beginning of ourselves, or starting all over again. Start right now, because each new moment is, in fact, really a new moment.
Mm.
And it's a very simple and powerful model. And it models what you do in this moment, how you leave and how to come back.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, as we're talking, and if people start getting interested and want a real practical ability to work with this and practice it, there's a free e-course on my website called The Mandala of Being. And so if someone goes to my website, which is www.richardmoss.com, they can just go to the free course. And there's five sections, 5 weeks. I think you can do it at any speed you want, but basically it uploads the new part every week for 5 weeks. And it teaches about being in the now, it has inductions for coming back to the now when you're in very kind of troubled situations, and it shows you about your me stories and what they're like and how you make them, and your you stories and what they do and so forth, and the past and the future stories. And once you really begin to see this is what I'm doing now, I'm in the future, or I'm in the past, or I'm in me stories or you stories, the choice immediately becomes to simply be where you are, which is the best place you can possibly be right now, right here.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, some people will say, but it's not the best place. I was just out in Montreal. We did a training at the center, the Quebec Center for PNL, And one of the women said, but you know, I come back to the present moment, and it just doesn't feel good, and I don't feel good in my body.
Mm.
And I said, well, are you ill? Do you have a cold, the flu? She said, no, I'm not sick, but I just don't feel good in my body. And I just worked with her for about 15 or 20 minutes. I said, okay, what is it that you're calling, I don't feel good in my body? Go turn your awareness directly in this moment to that sensation. And she began to notice the sensation. We began to stay with it. I didn't let her go into the past, the future. I guided her not to go into the past or the future, interpret it. And after a while, she could kind of visualize something hot and hard in her belly. And then after a while, it began to change, and it became space, more spacious. And then it began to be warmth in her chest. And then within about 15 minutes, she's standing there in a completely different posture, describing how her spine feels straight and her body feels like it's warm and alive. And I basically said, you see, here's the problem. It's not that you don't feel good in your body. It's that you've been you've not been actually consciously using your awareness to be present for this sensation, and you've been calling it bad names and making yourself feel bad. But if you actually enter it deeply, in the way I just described, it can change, because you know weather always changes, and our feeling nature is a kind of interior weather that gives us our sense of self, our sense of being. And it's always changing, and the only reason it stops changing is when we tie it up with thoughts and turn it into emotions. And we say, for example, the story, I was abandoned, my mother abandoned me, you know, not intentionally, but when I was 13. And then that emotion or that feeling of abandonment with that story, it rebuilds itself continuously until you can disconnect the thought from it. And then your feeling starts to flow normally again, constantly changing, constantly giving you new information. Feeling is an essential way of knowing. It's a mode of consciousness. And most of us, all we know are emotions. All we know are the kinds of feelings that are created by our stories.
Hmm. Now, the other thing I like is, you know, there are a lot of spiritual teachers out there right now, and I think their intention is for the best, but the way it's explained and the fact that we don't understand it, when they talk about us needing to become detached from our emotions, it recreates the problem, which is that we just completely avoid it. And so you talk about conscious suffering versus a neurotic suffering, but that, you know, if we can do things consciously, that, you know, our awareness will allow that edge or that energy that we've been pushing onto or avoiding or pushing away or whatever our, you know, mechanisms are, that, you know, it will lose that energy and we can bring ourselves back to ourselves.
Yeah. You know, what I think is that we confuse ourselves with our own language.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe people that are listening now, when I use the word feeling, let's say in comparison to thinking, everybody knows that with thinking, you create a concept about something, and then you, by examining that concept, let's say you create a concept about a tree, or you create a concept about a mathematical concept or a geometric concept. And so with thinking, we address the world and we learn a lot about it. Then because we are living creatures, we have feeling. Some of the feeling is sensation. But there's another category of feeling, which is emotion. And in our language, we constantly change. We confuse the word feeling and emotion all the time. So we say, I feel angry. And that's true. The sensation that's present is anger. But anger is an emotion, and you can only have it because you're telling yourself a story that makes you angry.
Mm.
You can't have it longer than for a second or two without that story. You can't have envy, for example, without saying to yourself, he doesn't deserve what he has. Or you can't have jealousy without telling yourself a story. She's taking him away from me. Or he got the promotion and I didn't. so emotions, in the way that I'm saying this, and I think this is really time in our world that we understand that emotions are created by our thinking, and that feelings are created because we are living organisms and we are constantly being influenced by everything around us, and we get information about ourselves and about other people. We know right away if something feels right or something feels wrong, and we don't have to think. And we know whether we trust someone or whether we feel good about someone. And we know that we feel good in ourselves or we don't feel good in ourselves. And we know this through feeling. And it's constantly changing. And most of us are afraid of the difficult feelings. And there are some very difficult feelings, like abandonment. Now, a certain kind of abandonment would be making you a victim, a depressive, special person, because you were left behind or you weren't cared about. And those kinds of stories create anger or bitterness or sorrow, and that can be confused with abandonment. But a child that's left alone isn't thinking. A baby left alone isn't thinking. And the sensation of being left alone is a sensation we would not be able to necessarily agree that we all understand. We could put the word abandonment on it, but it implies we're left alone because we're rejected or we're not cared about. But just to be left alone creates a funny feeling. Just the loss of someone when they die creates a sensation. And if you just address that feeling without putting any thoughts on it, you can travel profoundly in your life in a very different way. To give an example, one of my long students, we'd had a chance to work on the kinds of stories about her marriage, and she ended up divorcing over the course of years of work. And we had a chance to work on, she had a chance to look at her stories about her son, who from very early in life started having troubles with learning and eventually had trouble with drugs as a teenager and trouble with school and, you know, not going to school and getting in trouble with the police. It was very, very difficult for her. And she tried everything. She struggled with everything. But we worked on her stories, particularly the stories about being a failed mother, or the stories about her husband not showing up well enough for the son, or the stories about the son, that he should be different, that he should go to school, that he should get his life together. And all of these kinds of stories just continued to create deep unhappiness. And over time, she learned to disconnect from them, and her relationship with her son improved tremendously. Because she wasn't looking at him and saying, you need to be different. She was just looking at him and seeing him as he was, so love could flow between them. But then, a couple of years ago, he committed suicide.
Mm.
And she had a phone call, her cell phone, while she's driving the car about a half an hour away from home, that this has happened. And she thought about all the stories she had about him, and she already knew them. She'd looked at them, and she knew what they created in her emotionally. So she told a group of people about a year after his death. And here's what she said. She said, you know, after he died, I experienced the most incredible sensations and feelings. I wouldn't wish them on anyone, but I never for one moment suffered. Because suffering would have been to say, I failed as a mother. And suffering would have been to turn to the father, her ex-husband, and blame him. And really, miserable suffering would have been to say, he shouldn't have done this. He was irresponsible. He didn't give enough. He didn't try hard enough. Those thoughts torment people. People who are listening right now, you know, you torment yourself with your thoughts. Now, that's not written. God doesn't say you have to feel that. Those kinds of emotions, you have to realize, are things you're telling yourself, and if you believe them, if you identify with them, they are going to make you very unhappy. This woman lost her son. She went through grief, and when there is no guilt, grief is a very pure and profound feeling that is sometimes very painful, but sometimes very uplifting. She went through incredibly difficult feelings. As she said, she couldn't even describe them. She couldn't even put words on them. And she purposely didn't put words on them. But there was never suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so important for us to know that we have that power in our awareness, not to disconnect from our feelings, to in fact feel them very deeply, but to not give them to our ego and let it become, I mean, imagine she loses, her son commits suicide and it becomes about her being a bad mother. That's pure narcissism, and we don't see it that way. Or it becomes about a bad husband, a bad father, and that too is unfair and cruel. Not only, it's not just cruel to the father or the husband, it's cruel to the person, to the mother who thinks that thought, because she becomes bitter.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason for a human being to be bitter in the present moment, but there's every reason for a human being to feel everything from joy and ecstasy and warmth and wonderment and delight to darkness and abysmal, difficult feelings. In the old times, we had an expression for those dark feelings. We called it the underworld. And in the hero's journey or the heroine's journey in mythology, you always have to go to the underworld. And whether you're taken there by illness or you're taken there by loss or death or you're just simply taken there in the way some of the great saints have been taken into all of them have been taken into very dark, difficult places. And these dark, difficult places are really just places of difficult feeling. And all of us have this, all of us. But if you give it to your ego, it becomes about you. It becomes a story of what's wrong with you or what's wrong with someone else. And then that's really unnecessary suffering. But if you stay with your awareness, these are passages, and they're transformational passages. You can really grow, really deepen in your humanity, in your compassion, in your sense of forgiveness, in your sense of acceptance, and really start to experience gratitude. Gratitude for everything, gratitude for life itself. I don't think this woman would say she was grateful that her son died. I think she'd say, I experienced depths of humanity that connected me to loss that every human being anywhere on the planet throughout time has felt. I became one with every mother that lost a child or father that lost a child. I became one with all of the parents that saw their children go off to war and not come home, and the babies that were born, stillborn, or died in childbirth. I mean, she said it was like she knew that universe of feeling, but it wasn't suffering. It was life. And in connection to life in that way, it's impossible. You become a human being of substance. You know, I knew her for, I've known her 5, 6, 7 years. When I heard her say, I have not for a moment suffered, this is a very thin woman, almost no flesh on her bones, always been that way as far as I know. And yet her voice was like the voice of something coming from deep in the earth. This was a person who had backbone. I mean, just solidity. Mm-hmm. This is a person who could stand with you in anything. And unpretentious, not grandiose, solid, humble. Really, that the kind of journey I pray for all human beings, which is why I share my work and
right. Why
I'm so happy we're talking about this book.
Wow. So I know we've briefly touched on them, and, you know, again, we have a little bit more than 20 minutes, so we can't go into too much, but let's try and break down these stories that we tell ourselves. Let's go into the me story first, because I think that's where we create that victim mentality, or we create, you know, these stories that seem to either we're a victim or the victor, and we, you know, as you say, we're either trying to be someone bigger or we're making ourselves someone smaller.
So, okay, you've said it very clearly. What it means to be special is that you stand out to yourself. You recognize yourself, and or you imagine that you stand out to other people. So you could never appraise yourself exactly as you are. That's not possible. If the ego could be neutral, that would be pure awareness. So what happens is that we tell ourselves a story about ourselves that makes us a little bit bigger, and it takes the form of something like, "Listen to me." Just the statement, "Listen to me," or the belief, "I know better," or "I'm smarter," or "I'm more loyal," or "I can do it better than you can." And so I call that grandiose specialness. You tell yourself a story, in a particular situation. Now, it may be true that you could do something better than me. But in humility, you would just do what you do, and you wouldn't be superior at all. And you might be very compassionate and patient with me until I learn to do things as well as you if I can, right? That would be a great teacher. Let's say I'm a very good violin player, and I'm going to teach you the violin, but you just don't learn very fast, and I'm inferior, and so you stop studying with me. But we can understand grandiosity, and we can understand that what it does is it makes things unimportant or insignificant, and we know that grandiose leaders tend to make terrible mistakes. There's good research about that. And the more depressive leaders tend to be much more judicious and cautious and don't make such serious mistakes. But let's go to the other side of the coin. Some people don't tell themselves stories that they're smarter. They tell themselves stories that they're not as smart. I'm slow to learn. You know, I can't do that. I'm not as good as the other people. I'm too fat. I'm not lovable. Those that are the me stories. This is a habit. It's a habit of creating a depressive holding environment, a state, a continuous familiar emotional state, by tending, not in every context, because sometimes you could be depressive in one context, like maybe around trying to deal with money, and you could be grandiose in another context, maybe because you're a good painter, and then you tell yourself grandiose stories about how wonderful your art is and how the world doesn't appreciate you and how people don't get the subtlety of your genius. But on the other side, you tell yourself, I don't make as much money as so-and-so, and I'm always going to be poor. And so that's the me stories.
I think in the circle that I'm a part of, it would probably be the, well, my vibration is higher than yours, or I'm more evolved than you are, or...
Yeah, and you know what the truth of all these stories are? It's just that it makes you feel superior for a few seconds. And any person who uses a thought to make themselves superior actually is afraid of a deeper feeling of insecurity and inferiority, because the shadow of grandiosity is always inferiority.
Mm-hmm.
And so all you have to do is say, wait a minute, I actually don't want to be defined by these stories. I'd like to find out who I really am without any thought in this moment, vibrating to my true nature, to my eternal self. And in order to do that, I have to be in the present. I just have to come back to the present moment. And then I can't compare myself to anyone else, because there's no one you could compare yourself to. There's only one Richard Moss, and there's only one Laurie Houston, and there's only one of each of us. And none of us are identical. Even if we're identical twins, we're different. We have different atoms in our bodies, and different ways ultimately of interpreting experience and reacting to experience. And so to be truly authentic, to really truly be authentic, you have to stand in the present moment and not be determined by stories that make you special in a grandiose way, puff you up, or stories that make you special in a depressive way and shrink you down. And we can go over to the you stories.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have two effects. You're going to tell yourself a story about someone, and it's ultimately going to make you angry or hurt. So think about it. You just look and you say, if you're in grandiosity, chances are you're going to tell a story about someone else that makes you angry, impatient, intolerant. You know, they're not doing it good enough, they're not smart enough, they don't care, they don't try hard enough. And when you tell yourself that kind of story, you become angry. So that's your internal atmosphere. That's you pollute yourself in the present moment with anger, telling a story about someone else that's judgmental, impatient, intolerant. Or you make yourself a very conflicted kind of state. You tell yourself a story that creates jealousy or envy, and one minute you're feeling superior, and the next moment you're feeling inferior. One moment you're angry at that person, the next moment you're angry at yourself. And all of this is being created by your mind, and if you'd stop and watch, you'd go, oh, that's a you story, and it's making me jealous. Oh, that's a you story, and it's making me judgmental. And then I turn to people and I ask them, so what's the truth of a judgment? Whether it's about you or it's about a... I mean, we have political pundits, and there's There's a guy named Rush Limbaugh has a contract for $400 million, and all he does is express angry, judgmental opinion. That's all he does, all day long on the radio. And he, you know, he praises the people that he believes in, and then he just attacks the other people. He has no data, no facts, no evidence. It's all judgment.
Mm.
And he's addicted to pain-killing drugs. Mm. He's obese, overweight. He drinks too much alcohol. The reason is because what he does to make money poisons him as much as it poisons the people who listen to him. Now, if you agree with them, you don't feel poisoned, but you're poisoned by your anger, your judgmentalness, your resentment. It's a really kind of funny thing. You look out there at the world, and people, we worry about poisoning the air and the water, and it's a serious problem, but with every single thought, we pollute ourselves. And that's what the use stories do. And if I tell a different story about God than you do, so maybe we fight with each other or don't trust each other. And nobody knows anything about God, and yet the preachers preach their stories about God, and some other preacher preaches a different story about God. You know, for a deeply spiritual person, the thought of God stops the mind. But for the ego, the thought of God starts lots of words flowing. And they preach them on the radio, and they preach it from the pulpit, word after word after word, which is nothing but opinion. Nobody knows anything about God. Oh, they say, I know about God because I read Scripture. But the Scriptures were written by people, and that was their opinions. Inspired, maybe, in some way, but still being interpreted by others. And look at the mess we make with our use stories. Religious warfare, political fighting, husbands and wives fighting. He says to her, you don't care about me. She says to him, you don't try hard enough. He says to her, you should go out and, you know, get a life. And she says to him, you don't care about me and the kids. And every one of those thoughts poisons the speaker and poisons the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And if you came back to the present moment, what would be there? Well, something quite exquisitely beautiful could be there, or maybe some feelings that from very early in life you've been afraid to let yourself feel. And if you use your awareness, you're bigger than anything that you're feeling, and you can be with it.
Yeah.
My work has helped people stop being afraid and start being much more authentic.
Right. I think some of the biggest parts of the you stories that sort of touched me was, you know, we so try to control everyone around us. We're so wanting to be in control. We think that we can do that. We're looking for approval, so we're trying to please. You know, we're also, you know, with the you story, we're trying to fix and save and help other people. I mean, it's really quite fascinating what we do when we tell you stories.
And we tell them, let's say you want approval. Why do you want approval? Because some sensation is in your body that scares you and you don't know how to hold it. And if you could hold it, let's say it's a feeling of insecurity or a feeling of that the story would be, I'm not seen or I'm not loved. But if you take those words away, it's actually a sensation, you know. And if you just let yourself hold that sensation like you would hold a distressed child, that sensation stops being so scary. And the next thing you know, you're connected to yourself, you feel good in yourself, and now you don't need approval. The approval, the searching for approval, the rejecting of people who don't approve of you, the elevating of people that you get approval from, all of that starts with a feeling in you that you haven't learned to consciously hold with your awareness. Isn't it amazing?
It really is.
I mean, it all starts in the now. There's a now of a sensation that scares people, and it throws them into behaviors that they think will protect them from that sensation, protect them from that feeling. And you don't need to be protected from any feeling, because if you are aware of it, you're much bigger than whatever you're aware of. You have to be. You can't be aware of something unless some part of you is more than it. You don't cut off these feelings. You just make space for them. See, I travel the world, and I say the job of every human being is to make a safe place inside of you for the kinds of feelings your parents didn't know how to make a safe place for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we evolve. And all the behavior changes because you don't have to withdraw. You don't have to betray people. You don't have to protect yourself if you're not afraid of your own feelings. And if you are afraid of your own feelings, then you're going to do exactly what you said, Laurie. You're going to try to control other people. You're going to try to, and you're going to say the most grandiose of all statements, if you change, then I'll feel good. And it becomes even more grandiose when people collectively say, or when a person says, when the world is different, when people are honest, when the government changes, then things will be better. And all they're really saying is, then I believe I'll feel better. And to me, I know the only time I'm ever going to feel good is right now. And if I have to wait for the world to change, it's never going to happen.
Yeah.
And in fact, if I really bring myself into the present and start feeling who I really am right now and the fullness of myself right now, I change the world and help it become a better place.
So let's go into our past stories.
Okay, past stories. Well, we've touched on it briefly before. Everybody has memories. But if you tell yourself the same, if you have the same thought today as you had 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago, I have people walk in to work with me, and they are still, they can tell a story about something that happened 30 years ago and be back in the same anger and the same resentment and the same bitterness toward their spouse that they had 30 years ago because they tell the same story.
Yep.
So that's how terrible the past is. If you don't let yourself tell a new story, for example, you know, he did what he did because he was looking for love, or he did what he did because he was afraid, or he felt ashamed of himself and thought this would give him a sense of, that having an affair would give him a sense of power, or would prove to himself that he was lovable. And you realize that's a new story. Now you're not a victim. Now you have some more empathy for the other person. Just as one example. And so that the truth about a person who comes into the present is you start to have forgiveness. You start to have gratitude for what you've lived and forgiveness. But if you stay in the past stories, you're in the psychology of a child or the psychology of a teenager or the psychology of someone wounded in their 20s. And you don't have a life at all. You think you have a life, but you recreate yourself. You recreate your emotional world and your psychology with your thoughts, and you become a person that you used to be instead of the person that you are.
What I really like, too, is when you talk about the fact that, you know, these memories are really just stories, and, you know, it's been proven that they're not even accurate.
That's exactly right. There is a great deal of evidence that you cannot actually remember any emotionally charged episode accurately. And that, for example, on a day that you're depressed, you'll look back at a particular memory and you'll remember it differently. You'll describe it differently. Then on a day when you wake up feeling wonderful, if you go back to that memory, you'll have a completely different take on that memory, and you'll describe it differently. And so the nature of the memory itself is being determined by what part of you is looking at it. So it really becomes important to just wake up and say, oh, now I'm in a past story, and this past story is making me feel guilty. Or now I'm in a past story, and this past story is causing me to blame. It's making me regret. It's making me feel nostalgia. Imagine kissing someone, and in your mind, you're wanting to see whether you're going to feel as good with this kiss as you did when you fell in love with that love of your life back in high school. You know, and so the present moment kiss just doesn't meet up with the memory. And so you actually don't taste the present moment. You don't taste the life and the love and the potential of the moment. Because in your mind, you're in the past. He's going to hurt me again. Makes you a victim. It means that love cannot possibly be recreated between you and somebody when there was a wound. But if you start in the present moment, and my wife and I can testify to this, we've a long relationship, and there have been bad times, and times where we've hurt each other. If we stay in the past, we could have the same kind of fight today that we had 20 years ago. But if we stay in the present, we find ourselves falling in love, I mean, in ways we could never imagine love growing when we were younger. Even when we were first in love, the love that is between us now, and we're in our 60s, is so far beyond that. As is the lovemaking. You know, people think you get old and lovemaking gets worse. It changes, but there's so much more love in it. Mm-hmm. But you have to start right now, in this moment. And we've done many things. I mean, I've hurt her, and she's hurt me. And if I live in those memories, and I tell myself the same story about what she did or 10 years ago or 5 years ago or 15 years ago, or in a way, you know, we turn our partners into our parents. Then we're not even actually seeing what they did. We're just remembering something emotionally from way in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kill love. If we're not in the present moment, love can't surprise us.
Beautiful. And
yet we keep dreaming about love. We keep dreaming about love, which means in the present moment there isn't any love, but it'll come next week when we're with the right person. Or we tell ourselves a story, it's never going to come, and we live in a kind of dull, diminished world emotionally, a weakened state. And love can come to anyone, anytime in their lives, anytime at all, no matter what. It doesn't matter how skinny you are, how fat you are, what you look like. You know, just you stop telling yourself stories, you come into the present moment, and love will surprise you again and again and again.
Mm.
If you tell yourself how love's supposed to be, you won't have any love.
Mm-hmm.
If you just come into the present moment and live what is, love keeps coming, just keeps coming.
Beautiful. Okay, so let's touch on the future stories. I know we don't have a whole lot of time left, but, you know, I think the anxiety stuff, I think most of us get, but you also bring up the part about the hope that we give ourselves. And I'd really like to touch on both of those because I think they're really important.
Yeah. Well, if you meet a person that's, let's say the Dalai Lama, and I've had a chance to be near him, to shake hands with him, or any person in your life that you know and you feel it, you sense, is genuinely happy. They're not happy because they're telling themselves a story that next week they're going to win the lottery, or next week they're going to, you know, the children will be visiting, and or that I'm going to meet the love of my life. Or they don't go to the future, but we do all the time. There's something bothering us right now in this moment. Probably we told ourselves a future story that made us anxious or worried. And it becomes so intolerable that we have to tell ourselves the opposite kind of story, one that makes us excited and hopeful. And I call this false hope, or I call it, you know, positive self-excitation. And it's cheap. It's sort of like going to the movies and feeling something for an hour and a half. But it has nothing to do with what you've realized in yourself. It has nothing to do with true connection to yourself. It's just a mentally generated picture and the sensation that comes from that picture. So in the same way that you poison yourself with worry, it doesn't feel like a poison, but you poison yourself with positive excitation for the future with your thoughts. By the way, in business, this is a real problem because many companies cannot tell the difference between a vision statement and a hope statement.
Mm-hmm.
So the hope is that we'll get more market share. The hope is that, you know, we'll have a bestseller. The hope is this. The hope is that. But the actual vision for life, there's no real connection to it. There's just this idea that something will come in the future. It's kind of like the craziness with derivatives in the financial market. It produces absolutely nothing. This whole thing that caused the financial collapse was playing around with non-real financial instruments that don't have any connection to anything. They don't have a connection to a commodity. They don't have a connection to a tree. They don't have a connection to a school or to food or to energy. They don't have a connection to anything. They're just simply betting on possibilities. And the excitation, like gambling, this time I'm going to win the jackpot. But they were able to manufacture in the financial market this insane idea that if I lose, I have an insurance company over here that pays me for losing. And if I win, over here I get rewarded for winning. They created an imaginary world in which they couldn't lose. And then they created a $100 trillion economy based on nothing. And then suddenly they realized the emperor had no clothes. Everybody got scared. The banks got scared. They stopped trading with each other, and the economies of the world shut down. And it's really an amazing thing that what happens in a human being with false hope, with just simply using a thought to create a picture that makes you feel good, but has nothing to do with you really being substantially connected to yourself and feeling authentically good, did the same thing in the financial world. And when people spend a lot of time in false hope, they collapse into despair for sure, because their false hope never comes true longer than for a minute or two. And it's silly.
Mm.
I'd rather have this moment and smell this moment and see this light and feel my body now and feel this breath and sense the colors and hear people's voices and look at their faces. And I'd rather have that any day than the sensation created by a picture I tell myself about something that might be wonderful that happens next week or tomorrow or next year.
Yeah. Well, wow. You've really given us a lot. And as I said, this book is, you know, really a great tool for a lot of people. I think what I will do is put that link that you talked about for your free e-course on the profile page that
I
set up.
That'd be very nice. It's so easy for people. I mean, richardmoss.com. And then right on the front homepage is the free web course.
Cool.
And it will... I've gotten, maybe 7,000 or 8,000 people have done this e-course, but I've gotten letter after email just saying, I really learned to change my life. Thank you.
Yeah.
I really did. You know, I've read The Power of Now. I know that it's important to live in the now. I just didn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
And what the Mandala of Being does and what the free e-course does very simply is teach you how to do it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I really hope that we can have you come back and talk more about this, because there's so much we didn't get into, because how could we? But I would really appreciate that.
I would too, Laurie. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thank you.